Welcome to our introductory course, 6-week introductory course in mindfulness. And there's still a few people coming in, so rather than me starting, I'll start with you and ask you a couple of simple questions. And how many of you here tonight are new to meditation, never meditated before? All new. And how many of you are new to this particular form of meditation, the mindfulness or vipassana? So, bigger group of people. And those of you who have had a meditation experience before, outside of this tradition, what kind of meditation have you done?
It's a concentration. I would focal meditation. Emphasis was on concentration.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to mindfulness.
Uh-huh. Good, thank you. What else? Yes?
Focusing in the center of the head, clearing energy, and
mm-hmm.
Cosmic energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great, thank you. Someone else?
When I was a teenager, I spent a few years as a transcendental meditator.
That's what I started with when I was like 19 with TM. Okay, so. So again, welcome. And what we'll do is, over the next 6 weeks, this Wednesday and the next five, I'm going to systematically lay out the main teachings, the kind of basic foundation in our tradition for mindfulness meditation. And it's usually we do it systematically, where the first day today, we'll talk a little bit about the basic of meditation posture and using the breath as part of the meditation. Next week, we'll talk about the body, physical experiences, and what to do with the rest of your body besides your breath when you meditate. And the following week, we'll talk about emotions and feelings, how to make those part of the meditation when they arise. And so rather than thinking that your emotions are not supposed to be part of your meditation life or feeling that they're getting in the way, there's a way of including them as part of it. The following week, we'll talk about thoughts and thinking. And the same thing, rather than thinking that assuming the thoughts are bad or wrong part of meditation, there's a way of including them in the mindfulness. So they're not an obstacle for developing concentration, calm, insight, the benefits that come from meditation. Then the following week, we'll probably talk about some of the hindrances, some of the things that get in the way of meditation practice, and then we'll talk the final week about how to carry the practice out further, how to expand it into your daily life, and so it's not just something you do in meditation, but something you can do in the regular life, and also how to deepen the practice in various ways. And in some sense, the weeks build on each other, so that learning how to be with the breath will make it a lot easier to learn how to be with your body. Learning how to be with your body will make it a lot easier to learn how to be in a mindful way with your emotions. Learning to be with your body and your emotions will make it a lot easier to learn how to be with your thoughts. It's almost like they're kind of foundation for each other. So so each evening we'll spend a little bit of time meditating together. I'll do some guided meditation. And a lot of time we'll be giving instructions about the practice. The hope that I have for you, kind of the expectation, is that you're here because you have some degree of serious interest, and that you'll apply that interest at home and have a daily meditation practice. I think that this kind of course will have a lot. You'll get a lot more benefit from this kind of course if you're trying the meditation at home in the week in between our classes. If you just come to meditate during the class, I don't think you really kind of get the sense of it. You won't understand it very well. And it won't really penetrate very deeply, even what I'm saying. But if you begin, exploring the territory a little bit, and you know kind of what the territory is like, then when I describe the map, you'll know what I'm talking about for yourself. So I'd recommend that you sit every day, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So my name is Gil Fronsdal, and I've been the teacher for our group, the Insight Meditation Group here in the peninsula, since 1990. And for many years, we were located in Palo Alto. And then just this year, we started here. We bought this building in November and started here. And in January. And before starting to teach the group in 1990, for many years I was a Buddhist monk. And first I was for many years involved with the Zen tradition at San Francisco Zen Center, Tassajara. I practiced then for a year in Japan. And then I was for a couple of years practicing in Southeast Asia in this particular tradition here. The tradition I'm going to be teaching you is called Vipassana in the Buddhist language. And Vipassana literally means clear seeing, to see clearly. It's cultivating, learning the ability to see our life clearly, to be present for our lived life as it's being lived. Can you hear me okay outside there? You're so far away. You okay out there? Yeah? You more comfortable out there because no attention is drawn on you? So Vipassana means clear seeing. And a huge part of the Buddhist tradition is cultivating the ability to see clearly. Clear seeing implies that there's a way of, that our usual way of understanding life is filtered by projections, assumptions, bias. That not often do we see things clearly. Our moods affect us and how we see things. So we're not training ourselves to see things in the Buddhist way. That would be un-Buddhist. But rather, we're training ourselves to see clearly how things actually are, to cultivate our own ability to pay attention. Now, attention is something we all have. It's not like a mystical thing from Asia. Attention is something we all have, and some of our mothers told us many times, you know, pay attention. Attention is a quality of our mind. It's like a muscle in the mind. And that muscle can be strengthened. So we can learn how to pay better attention to our experience as we're living it. What you'll find as you meditate is that how difficult it is to keep your attention in the present moment. Or how difficult it can be to keep your attention present. Because the mind has this tremendous momentum and habit of being caught up in itself. Thinking about the future, thinking about the past, planning, repeating conversations, improving on past conversations, planning better pasts. And there's all kinds of things the mind does. I think getting lost into fantasies. The mind kind of slips into that all too quickly. And then off we go, we're lost. One of the classic images given is if you're walking down a road, for example, and you come to a train tracks and the train goes by, you can stand, on the side of the train tracks and watch the trains go by and know you're here, the train is there, and you're not. But then some really interesting boxcar goes by, and the door is wide open, and so you jump on, and off you go, and you don't really notice that you're on the train until you got into Portland, because it was so captivating. So thoughts are that way. We can maybe notice for a moment, for a little bit, that we're thinking, and we can see them go by like train cars. But then some really juicy thought comes along, and you jump onto that thought, and you don't even know that you're on that boxcar until you get to Portland. And you can spend long periods of time lost in our thoughts without any real attention. So one of the things you'll learn in meditation is how difficult it can be for your mind to stay attentive. Don't be discouraged by that. That's actually considered one of the first insights you can have. So you're right on track. But then you start learning what the consequence, what the cost is for you for not being present, not being attentive. And you probably, different ones of you will find that it has different effects on you, that you lack of presence. To be lost in the world of fantasy, for some people means that much of their time they're disconnected from the world as it's actually lived. And some people spend an inordinate amount of time in fantasy, lost in fantasy. They feel safe in their fantasies. They feel interested it's more interesting fantasy life than real life. Real life is painful and maybe uncomfortable sometimes. And so people recoil from that, and one place that they recoil is in the world of the thoughts, getting lost in it. But the cost is we don't really see life as it actually is. And what we're training ourselves in Buddhism is to train ourselves to see it for what it is, whether it's unpleasant or pleasant, it doesn't matter. What matters is to cultivate the ability to see clearly. What happens often is that when we're not so conscious, when we're lost in when attention is not really strongly present, that it's a setup much for us to have stress and to suffer. It's a lot easier to build up stress if you don't get not present. If you get caught up in your thoughts or caught up in your ideas about whatever, what has to be done, and lost in that world, it isn't just your thoughts that will get lost and get caught up in there, but your body also. And many of you will probably know that when you're lost or caught up in some kind of concern, that it can affect your body. So if you're really anxious about getting some job done, that anxiety might take the form of tightening in your body. If you're really filled with greed and desire or lust for something, that lust can take its form as heat or tightness somewhere in the body. That the way that we relate to this lost, the way we relate to our thoughts and our ideas, in that world where we get lost in, has effect on our physical system and our lived life. And so as you start paying attention and noticing how much the mind wants to not be present, one of the things you can pay attention to is, what are the consequences of not being present? What happens to you in that space when you're not really alert and present to what's going on in your life? When you finally do wake up, look back over that and see what was going on in there. Do I really want to live in this kind of virtual reality? Which is what our thoughts are. They're kind of a virtual reality. The analogy I like giving is if someone was born in a room, in a house, and they could never leave, the curtains were drawn and they just lived in this house, but the house was equipped with this huge 52-inch television. And it was cable. And every possible, channel that the humans have ever made gets channeled into that television. And it's so beautiful and fascinating, and all these colors and activities and dramas and sports and recreation and everything, you can choose from there. It's endlessly, varied, the shows. And you get bored with some of them, of course, but you just change the channel and there's another one, great. And you change the channel and there's another one, great. And so you never get bored. And it's all the only world you know. And then someday someone finally opens the front door and you're allowed to come out. And lo and behold, you, for the first time, you discover a three-dimensional world. You see the sunlight, you see the stars, you have the breeze against your cheeks, you can smell the roses, and you start noticing all these different things. And you realize how television was a two-dimensional world. And now there's a three-dimensional world that has much greater depth to it. As we learn, as we begin to learn the cost of being lost in our thoughts a lot, one of the things you might notice is the degree to which it's kind of a two-dimensional world. It's kind of a flat world. It's very compelling. But it doesn't have much dimension to it, much depth to it. The present moment, the lived moment of the present, is a place where we can get into real depth in our life. And so part of the training in clear seeing of this mindfulness practice is a training to let the mind stay present in the present moment, to be present for the lived experience as we're living it. The benefits of this, which you can also pay attention to and learn as you go along, and different ones of you have different benefits from learning to be present, but one of the benefits is, or some of the benefits are, that a lot of things that most people most cherish, find of greatest value, occur only when we're in the present moment to experience them. Friendship, love, joy are really experiences that are happening in the present moment. You can have a memory of love, but the memory of love is often a very different experience than actually having a feeling of love in the present moment. And the more you can train your mind to be in the present moment and to rest there, be comfortable there, have the skills to stay there, the more access you'll have to some of the most wonderful things that's available in life. You'll also have access to some of the painful aspects of life. Because one of the reasons people don't want to be in the present moment is because the present moment is also where people suffer. The Buddhist tradition counsels us that you don't want to run away from your suffering. You don't want to avoid the beautiful parts of life by living in your thoughts all the time. But you also don't want to avoid your suffering. Because it's possible to wake up in the middle of suffering. It's possible to bring clear seeing to our suffering. And in bringing clear seeing, see behind it or see through it. and see some of the reasons why it's there, some of the causes for it. And then in seeing the causes for it, settle them, relax them. So part of the training in clear seeing is learning the skills to look very honestly at the places that we suffer. And that's not an easy thing to do, you know, and let alone have the motivation to want to do that. So the Buddhist tradition, let's see this way. There's a beautiful story of a Zen master. There's a tradition in Japan of Zen masters writing beautiful calligraphy and doing kind of spontaneous poems and wise sayings. People will come to them and say, "Will you please write me a beautiful calligraphied poem or something?" So this somewhat arrogant person came to the Zen master and said, "Can you write me? Here's some beautiful silk paper, or white paper, and here's beautiful ink. And on this paper, can you please write to me the essential teachings of Buddhism, kind of in a nutshell?" And the Zen master said, "Oh yeah, of course, I'd be happy to." And he wrote on a piece of paper the words "attention." And the guy said, "Oh, you didn't understand. What I wanted was, you know, Buddhism is a great world religion. It's really profound. And, you know, I want the essential truth of this particular tradition." And the Zen master says, oh, now I get it, what you want." So he took another piece of paper and he wrote, "Attention, attention." And the wealthy man said, "Oh, no, you don't understand. I'm talking about Buddhism, you know, this, you know, people study, you know, spend years studying Buddhism. They get PhDs in it and everything. And, you know, can you please give me kind of the real essence of the profundity? The profundity, the Zen master, the real profundity." "Oh, okay." Third piece of paper. "Attention, attention, attention." So that's really the heart of Buddhism, is to learn to pay attention. What we're doing in this class is learning to pay attention. You don't have to be a Buddhist. I don't really care at all. But I do care a lot about trying to convey to you my joy and love for the process of paying attention. And for the joy of what's possible when you do cultivate that in meditation itself. It's very valuable in daily life, and it's very valuable in formal meditation itself to cultivate our ability to pay attention. And your life will probably, the boundless treasures of your life will probably open up abundantly as you begin to learn how to be in the present moment. As we go along here for these 6 weeks, I'm a little bit sloppy in this way. In my mind, there's no sharp division between meditation itself and the mind that goes out in daily life. So, and for me, mindfulness practice is not something you do only in meditation, but it's something you want to apply daily life. So while I'm talking to you, I'm trying to be mindful of what I'm doing, that I'm here, that I'm talking, what it feels like to be talking. And I know it's very easy for me to get lost in what I'm talking about and not have any real presence while I talk. And sometimes in ordinary conversations with people, I'm so caught up with what I'm saying that there's not much mindfulness there. But for me, mindfulness is something I'm trying to train myself to do as much as I can, to be present while I'm doing things. So how I'm sloppy is that as I'm talking here, I'm kind of slide back and forth, perhaps, between talking about mindfulness in daily life and talking about mindfulness in meditation proper. And so I'm warning you, so in case you get, you know, what's he talking about now? And he was talking about meditation, sitting meditation, suddenly he's talking about how to wash your dishes. You know, so in my mind, you know, what we're cultivating basically is mindfulness, attention. But meditation itself is a really beautiful thing. To sit down, be quiet, concentrate the mind, get calm, and start paying attention is one of the great things of life, I believe. And it's very, very helpful. So, meditation. Meditation is best done on a consistent basis. The benefits of meditation come, there's a momentum that gets built when you meditate on a regular basis. And it's like running, right? If you decide to, you know, build up some stamina running, and you decide to go out running one day, yeah, that was really great. I've got to do this again. So, you know, a couple of months later, you go run again. That was really great, you know. A couple of months later. You're not going to build up any stamina with that kind of big gap between. If you want to really get some of the benefits of building stamina through running, you need to run every day. And then there's the momentum over the days that builds a kind of power, a stamina, a strength. Same thing with meditation. It's the continuity over... A single period of meditation is beneficial. So don't ever feel like, you know, I'm not going to do it. I shouldn't do it because I can't have to do the continuity thing. But I want to say at the outset that sitting every day provides a whole different level of benefit in meditation than it would be if you just sit intermittently, so every once in a while. It's best to do meditation practice, if you can, at the same time in the same place every day. So meaning that, there's a strong association to that time and place to meditation practice. And because of the associations, it's easier to kind of get into the mood, into that realm of the mind, into that activity. You don't have to do it that way, but it can be very helpful. Most people find that it's best to do meditation first thing in the morning. They're kind of somewhat fresh. All the busyness of the daily life hasn't started. And the phone is less likely to ring. And some people find it really helpful to start the day on that footing. It kind of sets a kind of a little bit calmer tone to the day when you start. Some people who do it on a regular basis wouldn't think about starting a day without meditation because it really conditions, it lubricates the day, it makes the day so much easier to go through when you have that kind of foundation of a little more calmness and spaciousness, openness in the mind. Some people, for whatever reason, will choose to do it at the end of the day or the middle of the day. And some people's schedule is so erratic that they just do it whenever they can during the day. But if you can do it at the same time in the same place, so same place means if you have a place in your bedroom or some place in your house where you can just kind of, that can be like your meditation corner. And maybe nothing else happens there. So it kind of stay, the associations to meditation practice are really strongly kept to that one corner. You don't mix it up with other things if you can. So don't, for example, meditate in your bed. Because there's other associations with your bed than meditation. And I know from personal experience how easy it is to sit and meditate in the bed and then be reminded of the pillow that's there. You know, and then pretty soon you're asleep. So consistency is very helpful, same time, same place. It's very helpful when you want to do meditation practice to have a stable posture. A posture that's stable and aligned enough, well enough, so you can maintain the posture for some length of time. And so one of the things, first thing I'm going to do now is I'm going to talk a little bit about meditation posture. And I kind of focus on this perhaps more than most teachers. So hopefully you'll find it useful. And after we've done that, then I'll guide you through your first little period of meditation. So any questions about any of this before I continue? You should interrupt me anytime you'd like if you have questions. Any questions so far? Okay. So, meditation posture. Probably the most important thing about a meditation posture is to sit... in a way that allows your back to be upright and alert for some period of time without getting too tired or strained. One of the reasons we're sitting on the floor cross-legged, for those people who can do it, is that it makes a nice, stable base, a tripod. Three points, your knees and your butt. And a tripod is pretty stable. If you sit in a chair, it's pretty stable in a chair, but it actually doesn't feel quite as stable for your body, especially if you don't use the backrest, as having this wide base. Kind of like you feel like a mountain, kind of like a pyramid. And you have this stability. And it allows the body to relax and settle downward. Anxiety, fear, mental consideration, proliferation often lends itself to kind of an uprushing of feeling, of tension, of pulling the body upwards. And some of this tension that we hold that pulls us up, pulls in our stomach, as it relaxes, it settles down. And having this good foundation helps us to settle. It's not necessary to sit on the floor cross-legged, but I'll first, those are some of the benefits of it. If you can sit on the floor, I recommend you sit not cross-legged, but having one foot in front of the other. So the legs are not actually crossed, but they're ones in front of the other, like I'm sitting here. It's called Burmese style or tailor fashion. It's also recommended you sit up on something. So you're not sitting flat on the floor. You sit up. Part of the reason for that is it's a lot easier to get your knees down, touching the floor, if your butt is hips are elevated. Also, if you sit up on something, it's easier to tip your pelvis forward slightly. So it gives a little bit more strength or oomph to the natural curve in your lower back. And it makes it easier to keep the back straight for some time. If your back is truly straight, it's actually your muscles have to work a lot harder. The natural spine has a little bit of a curve. And if you sit flat on the ground, tendency is actually to kind of curve like this, cave out. And that puts a lot of strain on the spine in the long term. And it might be comfortable for the short term, but in the long term, it's not going to work so well for you. One way to sit is to sit on these round zafus, usually sit in the front third of them, so you're kind of sitting a little bit on the slope of it, so you get that little curve on your pelvis. And you might experiment with the height that you sit on, because some people, if their hips are really open, don't need much height at all. If their hips are really tight, they might need a lot of height so they get their knees down. So what you want to do is try to have your knees on the ground so you get that support. So you might experiment with different heights. And you can get really high, but if you're too high, then you start to make having the slide effect. You slide off or the pillows pop out from behind you. Looks pretty funny. But if you can't get your knees down, say you sit like this pretty comfortably, but your knees are up in the air, then you can get another pillow or a towel or something and put it underneath your knees so they have some support, so they're not dangling in the air. Of course, you can sit quarter lotus, one foot up on your calf of the other leg, half lotus up on your thigh, and full lotus. But for most people, I think it works pretty well to sit this Burmese way, partly because it's more symmetrical that way. And there's less torque on the knees, less torque on the hips, and you're not pulling the body to one side or the other as much. So it's kind of nice to sit symmetrically. If you're sitting in a chair, the classic recommendation is you have your legs go straight out, parallel to each other, with feet, not the legs not crossed, but the feet flat on the ground, and be sure that your knees are not higher than your hips. Some people recommend that your knees be lower than your hips, and some people recommend that it's okay to have your knees same level as your hips. However, some people like to not sit parallel with the legs, but to have their legs angled out from each other, and that feels more stable. So either way. If you're sitting on a chair, you could get a cushion. Some chairs are kind of angled down. The seat angles down towards the back. It's actually better for meditation if it angles down towards the front. And you could get a little cushion or towel or something to make that effect. It's a lot better for the spine. If you're in a chair, you can avoid using the backrest. It's strongly recommended. Part of the reason for this is that, in a sense, in Buddhist practice meditation, you're trying to develop a kind of inner self-reliance. And that's because of the strong connection between our body and our mind, it's easier to find that inner self-reliance if the body is self-reliant, not leaning against something. Some people need to use a backrest. Please, it's fine to do it if you have to. But if you don't have to, sit away from the backrest. Allison brought me... There's other ways of sitting on the floor. If you don't want to sit cross-legged or break from it sometimes, one is to take these round cushions and to sit down, put it upright on its side, and then put it between your ankles and sit down on your knees this way. And that can be pretty comfortable. You don't have the tripod effect as much, but it's low center of gravity, which is nice. You can do the same thing with these benches. And have your legs go through the bench. Like this. And that works pretty well. Some people prefer those crescent moons that are there because of the way it spreads, distributes the weight. And some people prefer that way. And things like that. Allison sells these things, right? You still do? So Allison has a little business where she sells these things. You can buy it from her. I think she has pretty good rates. But there's other places to get them. East West Books is another place. And so once you have this, the base somewhat set, then you want to have establish this alert, upright spine, which is some people are not used to doing that. They sit at the computer all day and they're leaning forward or always in the backrest. And a lot of we have many, many sedentary people in our society and with bad postural habits. And and so it can be a little bit of a challenge initially to kind of sit up straight. Some muscles which are weak get sore from making the effort. Some muscles which are tight get strained by pulling against them, sit up straight. But in the long term, it's really good in meditation to go through the transition, the difficulty of keeping your back straight until you can start relaxing in this kind of posture and having a relaxed back, aligned, upright back. So you can take to establish the best kind of posture so that you can, you know, on the chair and the floor. And then take your hands on either side of your hips, if you can reach the floor or reach the sides of the chair. And lift your body almost off the chair or the cushion, with your chest coming up, out. And then as you release your hands, let your shoulders roll back and settle down. And perhaps some of you doing this will feel that you're actually sitting more aligned now. You're straighter, more upright. And perhaps even the feeling of the shoulders can relax a little more because our hands in meditation, you can do anything with your hands where both hands do the same thing. So some people keep their hands on their thighs or their knees. Some people have hands together. The classic way in Buddhism is to have your hands together, one in front of the other, often with the fingers of one over the fingers of the other, with the thumbs touching. And so either together or like this. And if you sit, what you want to be careful for is that you're not pulling your shoulders forward. So if you're sitting and your hands are on the knees, you might actually be pulling yourself forward and create a strain for your neck and your upper shoulders. And some you might want to try pulling your hands back a little bit. If you're sitting with your hands together and you have them resting on your heel, then some people find the that pulls their and creates a strain here also. And then what you might want to do is to get like a pillow or something, towel, and put it on top of your ankles so your hands can be higher up. And that can be easier also, just to have them higher. In some Buddhist traditions, they emphasize the value of having your hands self-supporting, not resting anywhere, just together in front of you and just self-supporting. And that's a nice thing to do, but you don't have to do that. In our tradition, we usually sit with our eyes closed, and gently close the eyes. And it's suggested you keep your mouth soft, gently, lightly closed, and you rest the tongue of your tongue up against the roof of the mouth. It's said that that will control the thinking mind, but you won't notice that. It's kind of subtle. So that's the basic points of posture. Is there any questions about that? Yes. A little bit further back against the palate, the top. Is that clear enough? So what I'd like to do is then do a little guided meditation to get you started. And however, some of you have been sitting now for half an hour or so. It might be helpful before we do this if you stood for just a minute or so and stretched. So take a meditation posture. Do your best to sit in such a way that there's a stable base. Spend a little bit of time kind of establishing a good, solid, stable base for yourself. And then take a little bit of time paying attention to the vertebrae of your spine and kind of get them alert, a little bit maybe more alive or energized, usually would, more upright. And then gently close your eyes. At the beginning of a session of meditation, it can be helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. 2, 3, 4, 5 rounds of this. And as you breathe in, feel a connection with your body. Establish a connection with your body, almost as if from the inside out, as the breath expands the torso. And then as you exhale, let your body relax. Shoulders, the stomach. Breathing in deeply. And then also when you exhale, to the best of your abilities, let go of your thoughts and concerns. Remind yourself that now for this session of meditation, the important world is the world of now, the world of the immediate lived experience. Letting go of all other concerns. And then having taken a few rounds of deep breathing, then let your breathing return to normal. And in our tradition, we make no special effort to breathe in any special way. No yogic breathing. Just letting the breath be as it is. It can also be helpful in the beginning of a session of meditation to scan through your body and see if there's any place of holding, any muscle tension that might be easy to relax, it. So I find it useful to do it systematically, starting with the face, the eyes, the forehead. Some people carry a lot of tension in their jaws. If you can even just a little bit soften that. Some people have tension in their chest or their shoulders. So as you sit, let there be a softening in your shoulders, chest. And it's particularly useful to relax the belly, to have a soft belly. Let your belly hang forward a little bit. As you breathe in, perhaps letting the belly fill. If the belly tenses up right away, it's okay. But at least at the beginning, make a little bit, one or two efforts to relax that belly. Let it hang forward. It's considered rather unbecoming to have your stomach hang forward. But meditation is kind of an unbecoming habit, so it's okay. So you start by taking some deep breaths. You continue by just relaxing different parts of your body that might be easy to relax. Having done that, then bring your attention once again to your breathing. Feeling, we're all breathing all the time. The idea is to feel how the body experiences the breathing. What happens in your body in relationship to breathing? The abdomen rises and falls. The chest might rise and fall. The diaphragm moves. The rib cages expand and contract. There are sensations of air going in and out through the nostrils and perhaps down the back of the nostrils. Become familiar with how your body experiences your breathing. If you have trouble noticing your breathing, you might put your hand on your stomach or your chest and feel that movement that's happening there. Some people feel it more in their chest, people more in their belly. Now, the idea here is to hang in there with your breathing, to maintain some continuity of attention with each breath. Of course, we know that your mind will drift away from the breath. When you notice your mind has drifted away from the breath, that's actually a very important moment in meditation. And what you do in response to that is very important. It's best if you don't judge or criticize that or be upset, but rather very simply, matter-of-factly, gently, begin again with the breathing. Whenever you can remember, whenever you notice you've drifted off, just begin again. It doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders away. What matters is that each time you notice it, you come back. And once you're back with the breathing, you want to try to sustain the attention there. Hang in there with it. When you bring attention to the process of breathing, that allows the breathing to help calm your body and your mind. It's much harder for your breathing to calm your body and mind if you're not paying attention to it. And part of the function of meditating on the breath is to help settle the mind, relax the mind from all its concerns. Relax the body, allowing the breath to relax you. Breathing in and breathing out. You can, each time you exhale, see if you can let go of your thoughts, or at least soften your grip on them. Relax with the exhalation. And then there's a little aid technique that we offer, we suggest, that can help. And that is, as you breathe in, say the word very softly in the back of your mind, just whisper in your mind, say the word in. As you breathe out, say the word out. Or some people prefer the words rising, falling. It's the belly or the chest rise and they fall. And the idea here is to use a thought, very simple, rudimentary thought, to keep reminding you to be with the breath. To be with the in-breath, to be with the out-breath. So rather than your mind being idle, free to think whatever it wants, it's using a very, very simple kind of thinking, pointing the mind to the breath, one breath after the other. And it's not so much that you're watching the breathing, as it is you're experiencing, you're noticing how your body experiences the process of breathing. And that you rest there, kind of like you're resting on the waves, like the waves coming up across the shore and washing in and out. So the experience of breathing washes across your body, breathing, moving in and out, one after the other. There's a kind of a rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. Hang in there for the rhythm. So we'll continue only for a couple of more minutes, two more minutes. And during these 2 minutes, see if you can trust your breathing. Trust that it's okay just to be with your breathing, that you don't have to worry or be concerned about anything else but each breath. So breath meditation has a lot of benefits, both directly and indirectly. Directly, it's a very rich practice and has a lot of benefits. And some Buddhist teachers will teach this is their only practice and say, you know, you can take just do breath meditation your whole career as a Buddhist and it'll take you right to enlightenment. It's so profound, the possibilities just in breath meditation. But directly, kind of very simply, it's a really great tool for helping relax anxiety and stress. And it's used sometimes when people are really anxious, you know, in panic attack, they're told to breathe deeply. And the rhythm, the continuity of breathing helps to calm the mind, the body. One of the ways in which this works is that to a great degree, stress, anxiety, is kept in motion because of our continual refueling it, getting re-involved in it, thinking those thoughts over and over again. And when we're with the breathing, when our life energy, our life kind of the energy, the food of our attention is going into our breath, it's not available for our anxious thoughts anymore. So if those anxious thoughts are not being fed, in a sense, then they kind of get weaker or settle away, get calmed down. And it's a kind of meditation on the breath. It's kind of like a retraining. We spend a lifetime being led around, many of us, by our thoughts. And you know, our thoughts are kind of automatic and we get pulled around by them and influenced by them very dramatically and caught up in them. And it's a whole retraining meditation to learn how to think in a wise way. You don't have to stop thinking, but how not to be caught by your thoughts, to have some mastery over your whole cognitive world so that you're not a slave to your thoughts. You can drop them or not be involved in them or change them according to what is wise and settle them if they're anxious. So one of the direct benefits of meditating on the breath is it develops concentration, it develops calm, it helps retrain the mind so it's not always caught up in itself. Indirectly, it's very interesting, trying to meditate on the breath can teach us and show us the momentum of the mind. It can show us sometimes that the mind is out of control. I can't do this. I'm trying to be on my breath, but I can't be more than with one breath every 10 minutes. I'm trying my best. I really put a lot of emphasis on it, but I can't do it. It's just like I keep slipping off. Now, one option you have when you notice that is to complain, get upset, depressed. But what I would like to recommend is that the indirect benefits of breath meditation is to show you the momentum of the mind in a way that makes it clear. It's kind of like if you go to a really calm stream that's in a very shallow kind of grade, and it's very clear water, the water is hardly moving at all, it's very clear, no ripples, no waves or anything. And you can look into that little stream, and you might not tell whether the water is moving at all. But if you take a stick and put it upright into the water, then you see a little wake, little waves get caused along the side of the stick, and you see, oh, in fact, the water is moving. You need a reference point to see. Or like if you're on a train, and you're out in the Great Plains someplace, and you see maybe, I don't know, a mountain great far in the distance, and you can think, well, I'm not moving at all. You know, nothing's changing out there. But then the telephone poles come right next to the train tracks, and choo, 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 and suddenly you can tell you're going really fast. You can't really tell your speed unless you have a reference point close at hand. The breath becomes the reference point for us to notice the speed of the mind, the activity, the agitation, the confusion, the automatic pilot the mind's on. It's said in Buddhism, it's much better to know the mind's out of control than to have the mind out of control and not know it. And the implication is that if you sit down to meditate and your mind is out of control, chances are it was out of control before. It isn't like suddenly decided to kind of rebel. Occasionally it does, but the mind is kind of this wild monkey. And we don't really see it. It's kind of like you don't see, you know, you don't see the air because it's always here. You know, I don't know why. It's because it's invisible. But like this, the fish doesn't see the water it swims in. We don't see the thoughts and the mind streams that we swim in because it's all too common. It's like, I don't know, it's like my glasses. Sometimes my wife, you know, I don't realize my glasses are filthy. Someone who teaches clairseeing, right? You know, I go around with these filthy glasses. And I don't know that until my wife tells me, hey, you know, you better clean those glasses. And I clean my glasses and I say, wow, amazing. And so I didn't know it. It kind of snuck up on me. Same way with our mind. We don't know what's going on in our mind very clearly. We're lost in that world until we have some reference point to kind of, that somehow highlights it. So when it's really hard to do breath meditation, your breath meditation is working because it becomes really evident why it's so hard. What's going on in the momentum? Am I making sense? In other words, you can't fail doing this meditation. Either you do it really well, you can stay with the breath, or you can't stay with the breath, and then it teaches you all the stuff about what's going on in your mind. Both are really valuable. But you need to have that, you need to try to be with your breath to see what's going on in the mind. And what happens is the more quiet the mind gets, the more concentrated the mind gets, the more you get concentrated with the breath, the more, you know, the greater subtlety you'll see about how the mind works. And part of the advantage of getting really concentrated on the breath, lost, absorbed in the world of the breath, is it can show the greatest subtlety at the very root of how of the mind, what goes on there. The other benefit that occasionally can happen with concentrating on the breath is it can bring a lot of joy. It can seem like a completely strange idea to someone uninitiated. Because usually happiness and joy comes from, you know, doing something, getting something wonderful happening to you. But actually letting the mind get absorbed, totally interested, totally involved in the world of breathing, letting everything else drop away, brings a lot of rapture, can bring rapture, rapturous rapture. You can have it very, very intense for some people sometimes. It can bring joy. The point of mindfulness meditation is not to have joy. If it happens as a byproduct of the practice, just be content with it. But don't take it as the point. Don't take any particular experience to be the point. Don't even take calm as the point. For mindfulness meditation, the point of the practice is to strengthen our ability to be in the present moment and to see what is happening in the present moment. It's about learning to see clearly what your experience is more than having a better experience. We're not looking for a good experience. We're looking for the ability to see clearly. Does that make sense? But however, this is maybe a little bit paradoxical or confusing now. In order to see clearly, it helps if you can be calm. The calm isn't the point, but calm is an aid. So, and one of the reasons we start with the breath is a breath, for most people, is a very good way to help calm the mind. And the more often you can let go of your thoughts, you're probably easier to stay at calm. Sometimes meditation works in reverse. Rather than getting more calm, you get less calm doing it. Don't worry about that if that happens. The psyche is an amazingly complicated realm, and all kinds of unusual things can happen when you go into the psyche. But even if the mind... So one of the interesting things, for example, you sit and meditate, and as you're sitting, if initially you feel your body relaxing a little bit. Great. You're on track. And then after a little bit later, you feel your shoulders are really tense. And they're getting hurting more and more. And so how can I be so... I'm doing meditation. It's supposed to help me relax. I'm getting tenser and tenser. How can this be? Occasionally it happens that way. But usually when this experience is happening... The people are not getting tenser. What's happening is the tension in their shoulders is being revealed. And this first initial calming that happened, relaxing that happened, was relaxing kind of the surface muscles that was kind of masking the fact that deep down inside, deep in this muscles of the shoulders somewhere, there was tension. And if you're chronically tense, it seems that the muscles kind of get numb after a while, desensitized to it. But as we begin waking up and paying attention and relaxing, unraveling the tension, that deeper tension reveals itself. So it isn't a matter that you're getting tenser, it's a matter that you're beginning to unravel that tension. Is that making sense? Your job then is to cultivate patience. Patience and discipline are very important qualities for meditators. To have the discipline, and those are qualities which are learned and cultivated and developed. No one expects you to have patience and discipline from the first time you start to meditate. But you have to. But one of the things you're developing is some modicum of patience and calm with your experience, being disciplined. Being disciplined to always start again with the breath, not giving in. The mind wants you to give in, give up, give in, get involved in that fantasy. But have some discipline to stay on track. Have patience with what happens. No matter what happens, it's okay. Just stay on track, continue with the breathing for now. You have to have a lot of discipline and a lot of patience when you have a lot of joy in meditation. Because that's also a great seduction to get lost in that world, to stop meditating, to kind of indulge in the joy. So it is not just difficulties, but also you need discipline and patience to stay on track even with the beautiful things that happen. So now do you have any questions or any report? Yes, please. Good question. It's been said that we're a sleep-deprived culture. And sometimes people need to sleep more than they need to meditate. So, you know, you have to look at your life and see, you know, you're getting enough sleep. Sometimes sleepiness happens in meditation because as a part of the unwinding process. We've been very tense and very active throughout the day. And as we unwind, there can be a period of time in meditation where we kind of start nodding off as part of that unwinding process. And then if you sit for 40 minutes, for example, maybe the first 10, 15 minutes is like a sleepy period, and then it kind of passes. Sometimes that's the case. Sometimes sleepiness in meditation is a symptom of getting too calm. And some people who think the point of meditation is to get calm will keep emphasizing the calming effect and will get too calm. And for the purposes of mindfulness, if you get so calm you're falling asleep, you're too calm. And what you need to do is balance effort with calm. So it has to be some kind of, if you're giving up all your efforting, all your kind of alert energy of being attentive and alert, then the mindfulness is not going to work so well. So you need the balance of effort, energy on one hand and calm on the other. So look, when you're falling asleep, look, do I need more energy here? Do I need to sit up straighter? Do we need to kind of arouse more energy, more alertness? To make more effort on the breath, for example. Another reason for falling asleep in meditation is it's a protective device. You know, babies, if they get overstimulated, like going to a really noisy room, they'll fall asleep. It seems to be a protective device of the babies to kind of protect themselves from overstimulation. Tendency seems to continue into adulthood sometimes in meditation. When strong memories or strong emotions might bubble up. If we have things that are repressed, and it takes effort and stress to repress things, as we relax in meditation, some of the things we've been holding down won't be held down anymore because we're relaxing, and they'll come to the surface. And sometimes the psyche is not ready to face those things, or doesn't want to face those things, and so it'll fall asleep. And just be patient with that and wait until you're ready. What to do when you're sleepy in meditation is a few different things. Patience is helpful. Not judging yourself is helpful. Sitting up straighter is helpful. If you're really sleepy, meditating with your eyes open can be helpful because it's a lot more difficult to fall asleep with your eyes open. If you could do standing meditation, it's one way of getting energy is then you can actually do meditation standing too. You don't have to sit down to meditate. And you can just stand. You can stand with your eyes open or closed and just continue with your breathing, but standing. And it takes more energy, and people are much less likely to fall asleep if they are standing. And that's a way, you know, to arouse the energy. I would often go and wash my face with cold water before meditating if I was sleepy. In Zen, I learned before going into the Zen meditation hall, you'd wash your face, your hands, your feet, and your neck. All the exposed aspects of your skin would be, you know, washed with cold water, kind of to feel more energized. If it's first thing in the morning and you're sleepy, you might not go first to meditate immediately, but maybe do a little bit of activity around your house to kind of, so the grogginess ends. So those are all kind of little techniques that help. For mindfulness practice, in its purity, what you want to do is to bring attention to the sensations of falling asleep. Become a student, an investigator, a researcher into what it feels like to be a human being who's sleepy. That's what mindfulness is, learning to pay attention to your experience. If your experience is sleepiness, pay attention to that. And then if you fall asleep, don't worry about it. Does that make some sense? So other questions? Or also, if anybody has any comments or reports about what that little meditation was like, this is a good time to hear that. Yes?
While we're doing breathing meditation, breath meditation, and something impinges on our senses, hearing or feeling, and we let our focus go to that in the here and now, or try to focus on the breathing and try to ignore the
Good question. We will, as this 6 weeks goes along, I'll talk about how to include the different sense experiences. Do what you said, you turn to them and include them. I'm going to wait until next week for that. What I'd like to suggest here is for this week is that you just cultivate mindfulness and the breathing for now, for the first week, and do the best you can over this week, and then next week we'll add to that. So what we're doing is like, if the breath is the center of the circle of our experience, what we're doing over these weeks is expanding that circle until the end, you'll have some sense of how to bring mindfulness to any experience whatsoever. But for now, do the breath. Yes?
A lot of times I find my feet getting numb.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to being able to move. So how do you handle that?
So the issue of legs going numb. It's pretty common, especially people who are relatively new to meditation, but some people it continues for a long time. It usually goes away after a few weeks. It seems that the blood kind of finds new routes to travel and it makes adjustments and it passes over time. Sometimes it doesn't. If your legs go numb from sitting, at the end of when you break your posture and you maybe massage your feet or kind of let your sensations come back, if it takes only a couple of minutes, a minute or two for your sensations to come back, it's your blood. If it takes 5 or 10 minutes for your sensation to come back, then you're pinching a nerve. And you never want to pinch a nerve. Never sit that way again. Come and talk to a teacher or a yoga teacher or someone. Figure out some way to sit so you don't do that. That doesn't happen again. Small adjustments can make a big difference sometimes with legs falling asleep. Meaning, if you sit a little bit higher, sit a little bit lower, get a different kind of cushion, the crescent moon, have more weight on your sitting bone and less on the sides of your butt and your lower back of your thighs. Having less weight on your sitting bone, less weight on your tailbone, more on your sitting bone. Just adjusting where the weight is, you know, here can make a difference. Further forward on the cushion, further back. Sometimes moving your legs a little bit, knees further out, closer together, moving one leg further out. Sometimes getting a little sock and putting it underneath your ankle so your ankle has more of a normal angle can stop some of the pinching of the blood. Sometimes lifting one leg up a little bit. There's different things that can be done like that. But if you're relatively new to meditation, probably it'll just pass after a while. Just be patient. And just be careful that you don't stand up too quickly. Does it get painful?
Just numb.
Yeah, as long as the sensations come back quickly at the end of the sitting. And if you're just numb and you don't bother by it, just stay with your breath. Yes?
This is a nation of coffee addicts. Will attentive detensioning be able to overcome chemical stimulants and attention causes?
Oh, overcome it. You mean you can drink all the coffee you want and not be it won't have an effect on you?
What I mean is there a greater difficulty in detensifying the body if it's chemically tense?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, we were developing sensitivity, so anything that makes the system more less sensitive, goes against it. But we have so much to work with that for some people, the issue of the tension that might arise and stress that arises, speediness that might arise from caffeine, might be the least of their worries for the first year of their practice. And for some people, it's a big thing. So it depends on, how your system works with it. Ultimately, what we find is that for many of us, that more important than resolving the issue of caffeine, of coffee or tea, is the caffeine of the soul, which is our addiction to desire, which is also a stimulant. And it's very, that's part of the function of Buddhism is to help us not be addicts anymore to anything, not be attached, that kind of firm, gripping attachment to anything. And for some people, there's a gripping attachment to desire. For other people, it's a gripping attachment to aversion. And for most of us, it's a little bit of both. If you're up for it, I'd recommend you stop drinking caffeine. I think in the long term, you're better off that way, especially if you're going to start meditating. But there's lots of meditators who drink caffeine, and it's not an ultimate hindrance to enlightenment. Yes.
When we're observing what it feels like in our body to breathe, is it best to have a particular point of the experience to put our attention, or can we just like float our attention throughout the whole experience, different parts of our body experience?
It's a good question. So the question is, is being with the experience of breathing, do you stay? Is it better to have one point, one predominant place in your body that you stay with, or is it okay to let your mind kind of wander around, and feel all the different ways the breathing affects the body, how the body experiences the breathing? I think both are fine, and both have the answer to your question is not some doctrinal answer. This is the right way, but rather for you to study what is the effect of doing it both ways. It might be that sometimes it's actually much more helpful for you, more relaxing for you, more concentrating for you, to kind of let the attention wander around the body. Gentle, kind of enjoying the body, being in the body in a kind of relaxed way. Other times, it's more concentrating for you to stay with one place. So you can see, experiment with both for a while and see what helps you the most. I know that my teachers recommended that you choose one place. Like choose the place in your body where the breath is most predominant for you. The air going in and out through the nostrils, the chest going up and down, the belly going up and down. And make that your kind of like your anchor. And the advantage of having one place that you choose is it becomes a lot easier to come back to it. If your mind wanders away, you have this default. You don't have to think about it. Where should I go now? I'll go find some place in your body. You know that you go right back to that place. You can start much quicker that way. And so it's a lot more direct. And also because you have the familiarity association with one place, in the long term, you might be able to get more quickly concentrated. Also, when you do start getting pretty calm, the deeper realms of concentration will only be accessible to you if you actually choose more like one point to stay with. So initially, you can do whatever seems most useful. But sooner or later, you might want to settle in one place. Helps you, that's different criteria you might use, but you might think that becoming calm is useful so you can start seeing more clearly. Becoming calm, it might be helping you be in the present moment. It might be easier to be in the present moment if the breath is more interesting. It's more interesting maybe if you let your attention wander around and experience different aspects of it. Oh, because you still feel like you're controlling it?
Yeah.
Oh, so the question is, can you hear you probably can't hear in the back, right? So she asked, sometimes she feels that she's losing the involuntary aspect of the breathing, implying that she's beginning to control the breath. And that happens. That sometimes you meditate, you bring your attention to the breathing, and it feels like you actually do start controlling the breath. If you do it so much that you become faint, or something, then maybe stop meditating. But many people feel initially when they notice that they're controlling their breathing, that, oh, this is terrible. I'm supposed to have a natural breath, and I'm not really meditating unless it's a natural breath. What we're asked to do in mindfulness meditation is to notice the breath we have. And if you have, and there's nothing wrong with having a controlled breath. It might feel a little bit uncomfortable, but that's okay. What you want to do then is become, just notice what it's like, what it feels like in your body to have a controlled breath and be relaxed about it. And the more relaxed you are about it, the more likely you'll go back to an involuntary breath pretty quickly. If you get all uptight about it, then you probably control it, you know, more. So it's okay to have a controlled breath. Just don't worry about it. Yes.
What time recommendation would you have us start with if we're brand new and we wanted to try to do it daily? Not too overwhelming.
I would recommend you start with 15 minutes. If you've never meditated before, start with 15 minutes, and then the next Wednesday, then start with 20 minutes. Do 20 minutes. The following week, do 25, and the following week, do 30 minutes, and then level off at 30 minutes if that feels right for you or challenging enough or whatever. If you feel like it's going really well, you might experiment with doing more, up to about 40 minutes. But if you're new, you don't want to push it. You don't want to kind of. Some people get really enthusiastic and gung ho, and they kind of push themselves too far, and then they kind of, you know, there's a backlash. It's better to kind of do kind of slow and steady. And with time, you might want. Some people, you know, build to an hour. You know, but they kind of build to it slowly. And but start with 15 minutes a day, and then 20, 25, 30. And after you've done 30 for a couple of weeks, if that's hard for you, for whatever reason, for your schedule and finding a time, you know, then you might go back to 20 minutes or something. But try at least for a week or two. Build up to 30 minutes. In a week or two, stay at 30 and see what that's like. Yes?
What sort of times do people in a monastic setting meditate?
Well, when we teach retreats, the normal length is 45 minutes. Sometimes they're an hour. In a monastic setting, when there's no schedule, when in a monastery and people are just meditating on their own, which sometimes they do, if their concentration is really strong, exceptionally strong, they might sit for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours sometimes at a stretch, and just close their eyes and just stay there and kind of enter into a concentrated state. Yes. There are four, the question is, what about meditating when you're lying down? There are four dignified postures for meditation in Buddhism. Sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. And this class I'll teach mostly about sitting meditation, but walking meditation is a very important part of our tradition. Lying down is fine to do. The problem with lying down is it's very easy to fall asleep. But some people need to lie down because of whatever reason. And it's fine to lie down. And you can do it just as well lying down as long as you don't fall asleep. And you're welcome to do that. A couple of suggestions lying down. Most people I know do lying down meditation on their backs. And if you do it there, anything you can do to have a little more tautness in the system so you're not completely relaxed will help you stay more alert. So very simple, not very simple things like bending your knees up rather than having your knees straight out, you can do that, can help. Or what some people will do is they'll have their hands in front of them on their chest, maybe, you know, like this, like you're praying or something, or have your... And so if you start getting sleepy, the hand falls down. And so you notice you're getting sleepy because of what the hand does. Yes?
Is grounding part of this?
Is what?
Grounding?
What do you mean? She asked, what is grounding part of this? What do you mean by grounding?
I'm familiar with connecting to the energy of the planet.
Uh-huh. You could do that. I mean, that's a nice thing to do as a preliminary practice for mindfulness. If you have access to that, get yourself grounded and feel that. But once you've done that, then let go of that. Okay. And what we're doing in mindfulness practice is we're not cultivating any particular connection with the earth. What we're doing is cultivating our own capacity to see clearly. And if you focus too much on other things like that, it could actually, you know, if you think that's the point, it can get in the way, it can get confusing. But if it helps you get grounded and settled and arrive here and helps you be in the present, it sounds great. So maybe a couple more questions and then we'll stop with questions.
Assuming that your posture is correct, will a sore back go away with practice?
I can't say. It's such an individual matter. It depends on what the condition of your back. Generically, kind of a general average person, I suppose, who doesn't have a back injury or something, if the soreness is there because the muscle has been weak and now it's being asked to work, or because there's been chronic tension and now it's being asked to release, that soreness will go away with time. If it's there because of an injury, then, you know, if your back pain really troubles you and it continues, you might want to come in before or after one of these classes, come and talk to me, and I can look at see how you sit. And sometimes someone from the outside, or go to a yoga teacher, can look and make adjustments to your posture that you can't do for yourself and alleviate some of the places we have stress. So, did you have a question up there? No? No more? Okay. So, so there's a handout somewhere over there that talks a little bit more about the class and about the breath, and it gives some exercises you might want to do. I call it homework during the week, besides the meditation practice, cultivating mindfulness in daily life. It's really interesting to study your breathing, pay attention to your breath in daily life activities, because the breath changes a lot depending on your mood and your emotions and your thoughts and everything. And the breath is a fascinating vehicle into understanding what's going on with your emotions and moods and all these things by noticing the varieties of ways in which you breathe. To come to a red light, for example, in your car, and stop, and rather than just kind of being impatient and tapping the steering wheel or something, pay attention to your breath. And you might notice that your breath is being held a little bit, a little bit tense. And that might be the first indication that actually you're driving in a tense way. And then you can ask yourself, do you really want to drive in a tense way? Maybe you do. Or maybe you have better things to do than be tense. Oh, Allison, besides selling, you know, paraphernalia, meditation paraphernalia, wonderful things like bells and cushions and mats, she also makes available these the tapes of these talks, these classes. So some people like to listen to them again, and some people like to, you know, can't come 1 week, and that way they can get that week's talks by getting from Allison. Are they in the library, past ones?
Yes, they're also. Talk about the audio.
Oh, yeah, so they're probably... We have a tape library back here. You're welcome to check out a tape. Please bring it back. And I think the past interclasses like this, are one of them or something, are sometimes available there. And no two, you know, snowflakes are the same, so no two classes are exactly the same, but the basic ideas are the same. And the other thing is there's a website called audiodharma.org. And dharma means like teaching, so audio teachings. And that website has all the, not all, but a lot of the talks that are given here at our center are available. You can listen to it on the web. You need an MP3 player in your computer. Most new computers have it. And you don't have to even come. I think the intro class is there.
Several
intro classes. You can choose between different intro classes. Probably.
Maybe you just have to do the archive.
There's an archive section of it, which most of them, like there's 30 talks that are easily accessible, and then there's hundreds archived. But that's archived in this guy's private computer in his closet, and he only lets people access it when he's sleeping. So if it's a guided meditation, it's archived. The list of all the archived things are there, but if you want an archive tape, you have to download it middle of the night. And it's very slow. Yes, Bruce?
The handouts, I know some people took two. They're both the same. There's one page and there's three pages. Just take one or the other.
They're the same material, just do a Xerox differently. Yeah. The last thing I should say is that, the way that we do all the teachings here at our center and all the practice opportunities is we offer them freely. So you can come and, you know, we offer them informally, freely. Doors are open, and you can come and go as you wish, and hopefully without any sense of obligation for anything, to stay or go or whatever. However, there's also the opportunity for you, if you'd like, to make a donation in return. And in fact, the center, the operation of the center, the paying of the building, my support all comes from donations that come through the two baskets that are in the hallway there. I don't get a salary. I don't get paid for anybody. My livelihood comes from donations I get for teaching. So that's it's a kind of unusual thing to do in America, to have one's livelihood based on donations. The association, some people have always like, oh, he's a beggar then, or something. And, I should leave him a tip. which I hope you don't think. But the idea is this is part of the spiritual tradition of Buddhism. It's a very important part of it to offer the teachings and the opportunities in this way. And the support comes on a voluntary basis and without any feeling of obligation. So we hope that that's the spirit in which we do it here. So we have two baskets in the hallway. One that says operation and the other says teacher. And so depending where you put your money, that goes to two different places. For the intro class, it's the only time that I ever offer you a suggested amount. Other times, there's no suggestion. It's whatever you would like. Part of the beauty of the system is that people who have little means, can come freely and, do what they can. And people who have great means can, offer more. It's kind of depending on what kind of evens out or kind of what works for different people. The suggested amount for the intro class is that each class, each evening, do $2 for the operations, at least, and $10 for the teacher donation. So about $12 per class, in other words. It would be delightful if you did more, and it's fine if you do less. It's a donation is something that you enjoy doing. You don't feel, it's an obligation. But the support and this wonderful thing that we're doing here, it's really great. Hopefully it's great for everybody to feel like you're participating in making this wonderful thing happen. And that's how you can participate. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next week.